Imagine waking up tomorrow, grabbing your phone, and seeing a global headline that the one thing every human being on Earth is terrified of has been permanently canceled.
I mean, that's almost impossible to even wrap your head around, right?
It really is. Welcome, beloved family members, to our discussion today. Think about how we interact with the world right now, just on a normal day.
Oh, we live in a generation that is completely, just relentlessly flooded with data. It's a roaring river of information.
Exactly. From the second your eyes open, algorithms are feeding you breaking news, tragedies, social updates, endless opinions.
It never stops. And we process hundreds of feet of this content every single day, literally just by scrolling.
Yeah, and the psychological toll of that constant exposure is profound.
It really is. Our brains, you know, they simply weren't built to carry the weight of global crises mixed with, like, advertisements and life hacks all before breakfast.
Right. It creates this heavy, pervasive fatigue as a defense mechanism.
Exactly. We scroll and scroll, and eventually the brain protects itself by just turning everything into a blur. Apathy sets in.
Because when every single notification on your screen has a red banner claiming it's urgent, well, suddenly nothing feels genuinely important anymore.
Yeah, and the danger there is that it becomes incredibly difficult to tell what is actual foundational truth and what is just another disposable piece of digital noise.
You just become entirely numb to the barrage.
Yeah.
But, you know, every once in a while, you encounter something that demands a real reaction.
Something that refuses to just be scrolled past.
Exactly. And that brings us to the very heart of today's exploration. We are focusing on a truly powerful sermon titled Living Daily Life Clothed in Resurrection.
It's such a striking title.
It really is. This message was preached by Reverend Lee Kyu Hyun at Hyeonggro Church, and it draws deeply from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 51 through 58.
And the central tension of our conversation today revolves around that exact numbness we just described.
Right, the numbness to information.
Yeah. The core question posed by the sermon is this: will we treat the resurrection of Jesus Christ as just another piece of passing information in our overloaded feeds?
Like just filing it away as a neat historical footnote to mentally categorize and ignore.
Exactly. Or will we accept it as life-changing absolute truth? Because the mission of this conversation is to unpack how this specific truth, if we genuinely internalize it, fundamentally shakes the bedrock of our daily lives.
I love that. But, you know, before we can map out how the resurrection alters, say, a Tuesday morning commute, we have to establish what it actually is.
Right, the physical reality of the event.
Yeah, because modern culture has this really strong tendency to soften ancient texts, treating them as comforting fables or moral metaphors.
Like purely spiritual poetry.
Exactly.
But the sermon emphasizes right from the start that the resurrection is not a myth. It is not some subjective internal feeling of spiritual renewal.
It's not a metaphor for springtime.
No, not at all. It is presented and defended as a proven physical historical event. In the Christian framework, this is the absolute core load-bearing pillar.
Because without the physical reality of an empty tomb, the entire theological structure just collapses.
It completely collapses. And to verify that history, the sermon points directly to the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Which is so important because when you look at how historical events are proven, independent corroboration is the gold standard, right?
Absolutely.
Like if four witnesses walk into a police station and tell the exact same story word for word, a detective immediately knows they colluded.
Right, because real history is messy. Real witnesses see the same chaotic event from completely different vantage points.
Yeah. The sermon's breakdown of these four accounts, to me, it's like having four different camera operators at a massive historic event.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it. Let's follow that analogy and look at the first camera through the Gospel of Matthew.
Okay, what's Matthew's angle?
Matthew's lens is tightly focused on the emotional extremes of the witnesses. We are talking about hardened, heavily armed Roman guards stationed at the tomb.
These were professional killers.
Right. Yet Matthew records them being entirely paralyzed with raw, visceral terror.
Wow.
And then he captures the women arriving with their own profound fear, which radically shifts into this overwhelming, massive joy and ultimately absolute worship.
So Matthew is giving us that unfiltered psychological shock of human beings encountering the impossible.
Exactly. But if Matthew is focused on the emotional reactions of the crowd, you still need an operator to capture the objective reality of the stage itself.
Right, to prove it wasn't just a mass hallucination or hysteria.
Which brings us to Mark. Mark acts as that wide shot. His account strips away the intense emotional focus and zeroes in on the cold physical fact.
Just the raw data.
Yeah, the heavy stone is rolled away, the tomb is empty, the body is simply gone. Mark provides the undeniable physical reality that anchors Matthew's account.
But, you know, cold facts and empty rooms don't necessarily change lives on their own. You need the personal element.
Which is the third camera, Luke. And his account is incredibly intimate.
How so?
Luke highlights the deeply relational mechanics of the resurrection. He captures Jesus physically approaching the disciples on the road to Emmaus.
Oh, right. These were men walking away from Jerusalem in absolute despair.
Their hopes were completely shattered, and Luke records Jesus walking alongside them, speaking with them, and eventually sitting down to break bread.
Showing he wasn't just some ghostly apparition.
Exactly. He was fully physical, eating food, and restoring their broken hearts in real time.
Which leaves one crucial demographic. Because whenever a massive event happens, there are always skeptics demanding empirical data.
Oh, always. And John acts as the camera focused squarely on those skeptics. He specifically highlights Thomas.
Doubting Thomas.
Right. The disciple who bluntly refused to believe based on hearsay, Thomas demanded physical proof to see and touch the wounds.
And the sermon points out that Jesus didn't condemn that, right?
No, he didn't. John emphasizes that Jesus actually provided that physical proof to the doubters. He highlights the ultimate transition from hard skepticism to unwavering faith.
So, synthesizing all four of these distinct camera angles, the emotional, the factual, the personal, and the skeptical.
The sermon arrives at a profound historical conclusion. Jesus could not be held by the grave.
And because he physically shattered the absolute boundary of death, his resurrection paves the way for our own.
That is the foundation, yeah.
Okay, so with that four-camera historical foundation laid, let's look at the cosmic impact. What did this event actually accomplish?
Well, if we zoom out and look at the entire timeline of human history, ever since Adam, human death has been the single absolute certainty.
It's the great equalizer. No matter how wealthy you are or how meticulously you manage your health, the clock always runs out.
Right. Philosophers have lamented for millennia that there is truly nothing new under the sun. Everything exists in a closed loop of birth, decay, and death.
Every building crumbles, everybody returns to dust.
Exactly. But the sermon, relying heavily on the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, declares that the resurrection introduced something genuinely unprecedented.
It permanently broke that closed loop of decay.
It did.
But wait, I have to push back here a little. If I look out my window right now, hospitals are still full. People are still attending funerals.
Right, of course.
Our bodies still age and break down. So the loop of decay looks pretty intact from where I'm sitting. How can the sermon claim death has been defeated when it still happens every day?
That's a very fair point. And the sermon navigates that exact tension using some really striking phrasing. Drawing from the scripture, it states that the resurrection swallowed up death.
Swallowed up death.
Yeah, and put death to death. To understand the mechanism of this, think of a highly venomous snake.
Okay.
If an expert removes the venom glands and the fangs, the snake is still terrifying to look at. It can still strike at you.
But its ultimate power is gone.
Exactly. Its ability to kill you permanently has been completely neutralized. Biological passing still occurs, sure. The physical tent of our body wears out.
But its permanence and its finality are gone.
Yes. Its psychological power to instill paralyzing terror is just gone. Before the resurrection, death was a solid brick wall, the ultimate dead end.
And after the resurrection, that wall became a doorway.
Beautifully put. Christianity is fundamentally a religion of perfect victory and absolute hope because the executioner has been permanently disarmed.
So the physical event still happens, but its teeth have been pulled.
Yeah.
It no longer has the final word.
Right.
That completely rewrites human psychology.
Yeah.
I mean, if you survive a terminal diagnosis, your immediate instinct isn't to just quietly go back to answering emails. You want to throw a massive party.
You want to celebrate.
So if death has genuinely been defeated, that cosmic victory should radically reshape how our communities operate today.
It absolutely should. And the sermon explicitly addresses this by pointing out a tragic contrast in our modern world. We are currently living in an era of intense, isolating individualism. Because of this societal shift, true communal festivals are rapidly disappearing.
Oh, that's so true. People are just retreating into themselves.
Yeah, even inherently communal milestones like weddings are increasingly shrinking into simple, brief formalities. We are losing the art of collective joy.
We retreat into our own little digital silos, curating our lives on screens instead of sharing space with people.
Exactly. And the sermon contrasts this modern isolation with the fundamental nature of the resurrection. Because it represents humanity's greatest victory, that great joy simply cannot be kept to oneself.
You can't experience the permanent defeat of death and then quietly retreat back into a silo.
You just can't.
There's actually a striking analogy in the sermon regarding a cherry blossom festival that captures this perfectly.
Oh, yes, let's talk about that.
A cherry blossom festival is incredibly beautiful. Millions travel to see the blooms. But inherently, that festival is laced with a deep melancholy.
Because everyone knows it's going to end.
Right. The moment the petals fall. A strong gust of wind or heavy rain, and it's abruptly over. The beauty is entirely dependent on its extreme fragility.
And as the sermon makes the profound point, temporary things, no matter how stunning, cannot be the subject of our ultimate praise.
Because they don't last.
Right. The cherry blossoms are a mirror for all worldly achievements. They are fundamentally fleeting. But the resurrection represents absolute permanence.
The eternal festival.
Exactly. To illustrate this, the sermon references Handel's famous oratorio, The Messiah, specifically zooming in on that overwhelming final lyric.
Forever.
Forever. Because resurrection joy is eternal, not fragile like a petal in the wind, we are called to actively reject the modern trend of isolation.
We have to reclaim communal joy.
Yes. We must gather, break bread, and throw a joyful festival together, mirroring the early church. They didn't just quietly acknowledge a theological fact.
They completely reorganized their daily communal lives around it. They celebrated it daily because the victory was permanent.
Exactly.
Now, I can see how throwing an eternal festival and singing forever works beautifully on a Sunday morning.
Sure.
But how does this eternal mindset affect an ordinary, stressful Tuesday at the office? There's that old cynical saying that someone can be so heavenly minded, they are of no earthly good.
I've heard that one, yeah.
Right. If my eternity is totally secure, doesn't that make my daily responsibilities feel incredibly pointless? Like, why should I care about fixing my roof or striving at my job?
The logic there makes sense on the surface, but the sermon vigorously counters it. It argues that the exact opposite is true.
Really?
Yes. Fully internalizing the resurrection actually makes our current earthly life incredibly powerful, urgent, and dynamic.
How so?
Think about the hidden mechanisms driving human behavior. A massive percentage of our daily anxiety, our greed, our relentless hustle culture, it's secretly driven by the paralyzing fear of death.
And the sheer scarcity of time. We hoard resources because we feel incredibly vulnerable.
Exactly. We scramble to build massive legacies because we are terrified of being forgotten the moment we're gone.
But once the resurrection frees you from that underlying despair,
it unplugs you from that frantic, fear-based survival mode. You no longer have to exhaust yourself trying to build an immortal earthly kingdom to prove your worth.
Because you already have a true, enduring purpose.
Yes. The sermon references two profound scriptures here. The first is Psalm 90, often attributed to Moses.
Where human life is described as incredibly brief. It says 1,000 years pass in a brief moment. Like a single watch in the night.
Right. And without the lens of the resurrection, that brevity is deeply nihilistic. It means your life is fundamentally empty.
Just a tiny, meaningless blip.
But when you view that exact same fleeting life through the resurrection, everything changes. This short span of years suddenly gains immense eternal weight.
Your temporary actions, your acts of kindness, suddenly have eternal echoes.
Exactly. It transforms your daily work.
It's like the difference between spending hours building a complex sandcastle right at the edge of the tide, knowing it will wash away, versus carving a single stone that will be placed into a grand cathedral designed to stand for centuries. The effort is the same, but the permanence changes the meaning.
That is a perfect way to look at it. And the second scripture the sermon points to is Acts 20, verse 24, featuring the Apostle Paul's ultimate confession.
What does he say?
Paul states that he does not account his life of any value, nor as precious to himself, if only he may finish his course and the ministry he received.
To a modern ear, deeply concerned with self-preservation, that sounds almost reckless.
It does sound reckless until you understand his anchor. True believers don't live recklessly. Once you discover a value greater than your own biological survival, you don't throw your life away.
You live a highly intentional life.
Deeply purposed. You become fundamentally unshakable. You can endure incredible hardship or even just office politics on a Tuesday morning because your internal anchor is firmly set in eternity.
You're not tossed around by the fluctuating circumstances of your environment. The pressure to make this temporary life perfect is just gone.
Completely gone.
Beloved family members, let's pull all these threads together.
Yeah.
We've explored the four-camera historical proof, verifying that this isn't just a comforting sable.
Right, solid foundation.
We've seen how the resurrection didn't just delay our physical passing, but actually swallowed death, completely breaking its psychological authority.
Disarming the executioner.
Yes. We've talked about trading the fading beauty of the cherry blossoms for an eternal festival, and how this security actually cures our burnout and injects our ordinary Tuesday with unshakable purpose.
And as this exploration comes to a close, the sermon leaves us with a highly sobering final thought regarding our current cultural moment.
Which is?
We live in a society that treats science and technology as functionally omnipotent. We look to laboratories to solve all our existential problems.
And science has done wonderful things. It delays decay, it manages symptoms.
Absolutely. But science will never solve humanity's most fundamental, terrifying problem. It cannot conquer death.
No matter how far technology advances, we can only delay the inevitable. Bringing the dead back to life remains exclusively God's domain.
And because of that hard reality, in a world often shadowed by the inevitability of the grave, the resurrected Jesus is not just a pleasant lifestyle option. He is the singular, true hope for the human race.
Which brings this entire conversation right back to you, our beloved family members. The sermon doesn't exist just to give you more theological facts to cram into your overloaded brain.
No, it leaves you with a distinct mission.
You are not meant to consume this truth like just another piece of disposable information on your feed. You are called to be a living conduit of this message.
When you truly realize that the ultimate enemy has been disarmed, you are freed to love outrageously.
You're free to serve selflessly. You're called to live so dynamically, so completely free from the fear of the grave, that God can actually use you to bring hopeless people back to life through this truth.
It is the ultimate wake-up call. It cuts right through the apathy of our modern age and demands a response.
At the beginning of our discussion, we painted a picture of how easy it is to feel numb, scrolling endlessly as the days blur together. But the resurrection is the alarm clock.
It boldly declares that the absolute worst thing is no longer the last thing.
So, beloved family members, I want to leave you with one final provocative question to carry with you as you step back into your daily routine.
I love this question.
If the ultimate, absolute worst-case scenario of your life, death itself, has already been permanently and utterly defeated, what incredibly bold thing would you do tomorrow if you truly believe you had absolutely nothing left to fear? Thank you for exploring this with us today.
A profound thought to end on. Thank you for walking through this truth together.
Live boldly, live with eternal purpose, beloved family members. We will see you next time.